Wake up, eat, work, eat, sleep, repeat, and try and have some fun in between. Even if your work is rewarding, it can sometimes feel like we're in a punishing, never-ending loop of our own making. Dr. Daniel Susskind is one of our leading economists exploring the challenge of smart machines, of robots, and AI. One day, we may be able to escape the loop thanks to advances in automation and AI. Rishi Sunak's so concerned he wants leading countries to focus on the implications and for them to act together on it. Tony Blair insists marshalling tech for the common good is the great challenge of the century. In his book, A World Without Work, Daniel argues that its true developments in these technologies will replace much of what we now do and have made the threat of mass unemployment real. But this does not have to be bad news. There will always be work. It will just be different. We could take this as an opportunity to find meaning in a world where work isn't the center of our lives. But then again, it could lead to wider inequality, greater power imbalances, especially from the new tech companies originating so much of this technology, and a loss of meaning in our lives. Historical examples such as Youngstown in Ohio, where Daniel visited, saw the collapse of the steel industry in the 1970s leading to severe job losses. Could a fresh wave of rapid automation replicate this, but on a mass scale? Well, here with the answers is Dr. Daniel Susskind. He is a research professor in economics at King's College London and a senior research associate at the Institute of Ethics in AI at Oxford University. Welcome to the We Society. Well, let's kick off at the heart of this. In the last 6 or 9 months, AI has really kind of leapt up the national agenda. I mean, there was the letter from some hundreds of AI scientists saying, let's have a 6-month pause. We don't know what this technology is doing. We don't know its implications. Let's just pause. There's been growing concerns about the impact on kind of the world of work. And then you've Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, is really wrong with this. He wants a big AI conference here in Britain. Tony Blair says, get this right and we'll solve our problem with public services. What do you think?
It's fascinating what's happened over the last few months. I think what's happened is a technology that to many people seemed impressive but relatively remote from their day-to-day existence all of a sudden was at their fingertips. It was this incredibly... I'm talking here of ChatGPT and the GPT family. This was a technology that, you know, all of a sudden was on anyone who wanted it. Smartphone, you could pose a question to it in everyday English and it would come back with remarkable answers. But so partly it was the accessibility of it. It was also just how impressive it was. This is a system, you know, I've been thinking about the impact of technology and AI on the world of work for 10, 15 years. And over that time, the number of people have said to me, but Daniel, you don't understand, a machine will never be creative. It'll never be able to come up with something original. It will never take us by surprise. It will never do something novel. Those are all ways I think about what problem we're trying to solve with creativity. And yet that seems to be what the sort of ChatGPT family is particularly good at, being creative, coming up with original arguments.
Music that you can't detect from the originator.
Quite.
Shakespeare. This is extraordinary.
This isn't a system that's just doing the routine, boring, repetitive stuff. It's starting to encroach on the kind of activities that many people think are the most interesting and important things that we do.
But, I mean, there's two points to start. I mean, there's one, you know, all the kind of excitement that you've just tried to capture. Mm. And the other, there's people who say, kind of, calm down. All that's happening here is massive computer power, mm-hmm. Trying to marshal patterns mm-hmm. and then reproducing the pattern. They're not actually thinking.
Yeah.
Calm down.
Yeah. And I think to some extent that's one of the most misleading features of the name artificial intelligence, because you're exactly right. These systems aren't intelligent in any meaningful sense. They don't think, they're not conscious, they don't have minds. They're not trying to copy the way that human beings think or reason or anything like that. But what they are is remarkably capable. They are taking on tasks and activities that until recently we thought only human beings alone could ever do. Making medical diagnoses and driving cars, drafting legal contracts and designing buildings, as you say, composing music and writing news reports. So these are unintelligent machines, but they're very, very capable. And in thinking about the impact on work, What matters is less how they work and far more what they can do.
I know a bunch of people who've got startups, and they're really quite alarming in the way they say that AI can now be used to kind of monitor and people's behavior during a Zoom call and then report back on how much screen time they actually had, their facial expressions, where they were attentive, where they weren't, and then mark them. You have AI controlling people on production lines. And that's just now. Imagine it 3 to 5 years' time. I mean, I'm simultaneously keen to embrace the new, but keenly aware of the threats as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I think the impact of technology on work, not just as you're describing, which I think is exactly right, which is how it affects the quality of the work that we do, but also how it might, in the longer run, affect the quantity of work that there is for people to do. I think this is one of the greatest challenges of our time. I'm very much alive to the threats. And as you say, you know, when you pick up your iPhone, when you open your laptop, that's the worst it's ever going to be. These technologies are only going to become more capable over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me what happens when I open up my laptop and my iPhone at the moment. I mean, what can AI do with the data I'm generating? How might it facilitate what I'm doing? And how might it help people who have power over me to be more empowered? Give me some sense of it. Give our listeners some sense of it.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that these technologies are both very capable in the sense that they can do a wide variety of different tasks. So if you're a doctor, they can help you make a medical diagnosis. If you're an architect, they can help you design a beautiful building. If you're a composer, they can help you write a very moving piece of music. But at the same time, and for a variety of different reasons, these technologies are also incredibly political. They have a very big impact on our political lives as well as our economic lives. And when I say politics, I don't mean traditional
Labour versus conservative.
I mean the way in which we live together in society, that they can constrain our freedom. So think, for instance, of a driverless car, which doesn't go above a certain speed, even if you're urgently trying to get to the hospital because your wife is currently, you know, having a baby in the back of your car. Ordinarily, you might put the foot on the pedal and go an extra 5 miles an hour over the limit. The car doesn't allow you
to. You go much faster than that.
Well, quite.
You're being very law-abiding.
I'm being very law-abiding on this podcast. Yeah, 3 to 4 miles over the speed limit. Or think about social justice. You know, lots of talk about hand dryers, which only detect white hands. They don't detect black hands because the data set that was used only included, you know, white hands.
This is very disarming.
That sounds relatively innocuous. It's a hand dryer. It's offensive. It might not be that consequential. But then you start to think about those kind of biases in more important systems that perhaps help recruiters decide who gets what jobs, or systems that help insurers decide who gets what loan. So you have these technologies which are, on the one hand, incredibly powerful from an economic point of view. They allow us to be more productive and effective in the world.
Give me an example of that. I mean, it's always said.
Yeah.
But give me an example of, you know, a really telling example of how these technologies are raising productivity. Because one of the features across all Western economies since the financial crash is that productivity growth has slowed down in all of them, and particularly in Britain.
Yes.
It's as if AI never happened.
Yes. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, there's probably a longer conversation to have about the productivity paradox in Britain. I mean, there's various fascinating features of it. One, that if you look at since the financial crisis, it appears to be largely concentrated in manufacturing and in financial services, that it's not a kind of economy-wide story. And that secondly, when you look at the distribution of it, it appears that one of the main drivers of the productivity slowdown in the UK appears to be that we have a longer tail of very unproductive firms. But
not longer than other people. I mean, we can't. I mean, I've looked at this myself.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
We don't want to get it. I mean, just one, and then back to AI. But
sure.
I mean, you know, the Germans, the Americans have a long tail
of
unproductive firms too. Yes. Our tail is not conspicuously longer than theirs, and yet our productivity growth is some fraction of theirs.
Yes. So maybe let's go back to AI and productivity.
I didn't mean to defeat you on this.
Well, I think the conclusion from what we're both saying is that we probably need more technology rather than less.
Absolutely.
We need more robots rather than fewer.
Yeah. Installed robots in Britain are the lowest in the G7.
Yeah.
I mean, phenomenally much lower.
Yeah.
Low levels of business investment. We don't, you know.
So you're asking for an example of something helping people be more productive. For me, the most striking examples, I'm an economist and I like to look back at the sorts of tasks and activities that until very recently leading economists thought could not readily be automated. And three of the big ones until recently were driving a car, making a medical diagnosis, and identifying a bird at a fleeting glimpse.
AI can do all of that.
Quite. Even on the latter, you know, there's now an app developed by the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology that if you give it a photo of a bird, it will tell you what you're looking at. But it's the medical one that really interests me because, you know, there are now systems that can, if you give them a photo of a freckle, tell you more accurately than leading dermatologists whether or not that freckle is cancerous.
Yeah.
Systems developed by DeepMind that can diagnose up to 50 different eye problems as accurately as leading ophthalmologists. Now, the potential for the productivity improvements there are really quite remarkable. But I think, as we're both saying, in practice, we don't see those technologies being used, and we probably want to see more of them rather than less of them.
And you can customize learning. I mean, you can customize learning. You can customize teaching. You can, and then there's all the threats. Now let's get into this.
Personalized learning, I think, is, you just hinted at, is absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's one of the few robust findings we have in education research. How powerful one-to-one tuition with a human teacher is. You know, an average student who receives one-to-one tuition will tend to outperform 95% of traditional students in a normal classroom setting. You know, one-to-one tuition is incredibly effective.
Well, everyone who sends their child to a private school knows that. I mean, that's the... It's too expensive to give it
to everyone. And that's why personalized learning is so exciting, because it promises at a far lower cost to replicate that kind of personalized learning experience that at the moment is only available to a really privileged and lucky few.
I'm learning how to dance, and one-on-one instruction is incredibly... I mean, if I was in a kind of group of 20, I'd be lost, you know. I'm not a natural dancer.
I think even in a one-on-one session, I'd be lost. I'm not a natural dancer either.
It's great fun. I'd recommend it. But let's get kind of into the... I mean, this is very, very interesting. Let's now get some sense of intensity of the change over what time scale, and then the kinds of challenges it poses to our capitalism, the way we live and work, and how we're going to respond to it.
Yes.
These are big, big issues. So let's get some sense of how fast. It's now 2023. In 10 years, where will we be?
Yeah. So I don't think the story in the next 10 years or even the next 20 years is one where we are going to wake up and find ourselves in a world of mass unemployment, where large numbers of people have lost their jobs because the robots have taken over. I just don't think that's going to happen. What I do think, and what I think we already see now, is technology creating a situation in which there is work for people to do, but for various reasons, they're not able to take up that work. One reason is that they just don't have the right skills, that the sorts of jobs that are being created require skills and capabilities which are quite unlike what many people are trained to do. Another is that jobs are being created, but people don't happen to live in the place where those jobs have been created, that there are geographical mismatches. And it's interesting to think about how we thought at the start of the internet era, those sorts of worries about geography wouldn't matter anymore. People spoke about, you know, famously the death of distance and how the world is flat. But actually, in looking for work today, the place where you live matters more than ever. I think finally, there's also some really interesting issues around identity mismatches, where there is work for people to do, but people don't feel it's the kind of work for them. And a classic example of this is men of working age in the US displaced from manufacturing roles by new technologies. And there's some who would say that these men would rather not work at all than take up, and it's a really unfortunate term, but take up so-called pink-collar work, which is a term designed to capture the fact that many of the jobs that are hardest to automate, like nursing, like social work, like preschool and kindergarten teaching, is disproportionately done by women. So people are willing to stay out of the labor force because the work that's available isn't the kind of work that they think suited for them. And those are the kind of mismatches that I think we already see today. I think we already find ourselves in a world where technology is creating work, but for various reasons, people are unable to do it.
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the WE Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. The more we can kind of automate routinizable functions, and a lot of them, by the way, are in white-collar work. Mm. I'm sure you agree. I mean, I know you agree. Actually, that liberates people to have kind of one-on-one relationships. So, you know, one-on-one carers, one-on-one coaching, one-on-one teaching, one-on-one sports coaching. I mean, lots of one-on-one relationships actually may promote denser, high-density human interaction. Mm. If we can leave all the routine things to machines.
I mean, yeah.
A rather enticing prospect, actually.
Yeah, quite. And I think that there is one path that we could take where exactly that happens. One of my fears, though, is that when you look at where quite a lot of interpersonal activities or activities that require some kind of manual dexterity, both of which we're currently not very good at automating, they tend to be concentrated in lower paid, less secure work. So I'm thinking, for instance, of, you know, people working in factories and warehouses or stacking shelves where manual dexterity is very important. Or I'm thinking of interpersonal skills that are required in retail or hospitality or working as a receptionist or things like this, where those things are very hard to automate. But it turns out at the moment that those are the sorts of roles that we don't reward particularly well in contemporary labour markets. And so there's an interesting, something I write about in the book, an interesting opportunity to revisit some, you know, the market value of some of this work, which is going to turn out to be the work that's hardest to automate.
You can argue as ever thus. I mean, I'm very persuaded by this new book, Power and Progress, by Darren Acemoglu and Simon Johnson. I mean, what they argued is that this has been going on since whenever.
You know,
for the last 1,000 years, there have been technologies coming through, and the incumbent elite, whoever they may be, capture the benefits. And the struggle is always to make sure whether it's a water mill in medieval Europe, the steam engine in the 19th century, the internal combustion engine in the 20th century. The struggle is to make sure that these technologies get designed in a way that promotes wider human benefit and the prosperity gets shared. And it's an endless struggle. And we now have another epic struggle breaking over us. But the instruments to deal with it, effective, agile government, strong labor organizations, strong institutions and civil society, have been weakened by 40 years of neoliberalism, brutally.
I think it's a wonderful book, and for exactly the reason that you say, which is that it is a struggle. The nature of a struggle is that it's indeterminate which side wins. There's a fight to be had. That technology doesn't have a particular direction, that to some extent the direction that technology takes and whether it tends to benefit the many or the few is in part a consequence of that struggle and that fight. And so we have to be thinking about how we can shape and change the direction of technological progress. I agree with your diagnosis that many of the tools that we would naturally reach for have been weakened over the last few decades to redirect technological change, technological progress. But I do think there are some tools available still. So, for instance, one of the things I found particularly striking in their work was their analysis of the US tax system. And it turns out that the US tax system incentivizes employers to use a robot rather than a human being for a particular task because the tax burden on hiring a robot is lower. You know, you don't have to bother with payroll tax and all the faff involved with that.
It's the same story in Britain. I mean, you can depreciate the investment, set against tax. You don't have to pay no payroll taxes. It makes much more sense to kind of invest in a robot than it does in a person. We still don't do it, by the way, to the same extent as the Americans and the Germans and the Japanese.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But it'd be quite interesting to do a kind of root and branch review of the tax system from the point of view of what kind of incentives are we presenting people with from an automation perspective. I mean, another good example is I'm very interested in technology and AI, and I spend a lot of time with computer scientists who are working on these technologies. And it's so striking how the incentives that they face are to develop machines that replace rather than help human beings. You know, the moment that a computer scientist slaps their colleague on the back and says, well done, is when they manage to outperform a human being, when the system makes a better diagnosis than a doctor, or a system is able to recognize, you know, images more accurately than we can. That's the moment of celebration. That's the moment when you get the research funding. That's the moment when you get the headline in the national paper. That all the incentives in that world of research as well are geared towards encouraging us to replace people. And so what I think is so interesting about that book is this idea that through changing the incentives that people face in the market so that it's not simply the pursuit of profit, but perhaps the pursuit of other values and other things that we value and care about, we might be able to change the direction of technology. And a new book that I've been working on called Growth is, in a sense, a generalization of that idea, that it's not just about automation, that we should also be thinking about how we can change the direction of technology with respect to the climate, with respect to automation as well, with respect to the impact that technology has on local communities and places, that this is a far bigger issue about what sort of technological progress we want to have and what sort of growth we want to have, not simply how much.
But see, this is a sophisticated conversation. I mean, you know, here we are. I mean, there'll be some tens of thousands of people listening to this podcast, and, you know, they'll all be thinking, well, how can I play a part in this? I agree with what Daniel Susskind is saying, and the questions that Will's asking, I hope they're thinking are quite intelligent, but, you know, they may not. But anyway, the national conversation is kind of not in this place. I mean, use of the state to shape technology, use of the state to push back on the power of these tech companies, the creation of, you know, for example, an idea I've seen floated increasingly is that if we can't trust information on social media, let's create a public platform like the BBC, where actually the information can be trusted. We'll all be on it, but it'll be mediated and monitored. And if you go on that platform, you can be sure the information isn't fake. I mean, there's lots of kind of, but I mean, our mindset is 1,000 miles away from that at the moment.
Mm. I think this idea about mindset is really important. I think most of us, when we navigate, and this is just a point about how we actually live our lives, most of the time when we use technology, we're thinking of ourselves as consumers. We're thinking of ourselves as using a technology much like we might consume a drink or a packet of crisps or something. It's just something that's available in the market for us to use. But these technologies have political consequences, as we've been talking about. And we have to think of ourselves far more, not as consumers, but as citizens when we're using these technologies, when we're using things like Facebook and Twitter.
I love that. So technology drives us from consumer to citizens.
And I think that kind of more skeptical, more cynical view of some of these technologies, thinking of it as a citizen rather than a consumer, is quite a powerful way of navigating all these new technologies in our everyday lives.
Keynes was writing a letter to his grandchildren in the mid-1930s. John Maynard Keynes, one of my kind of intellectual heroes, wasn't right in everything, but remains a hero. And he says to his grandchildren, you know, 35 years' time, 1970, you know, productivity is going to be twice as high, living standards will be twice as high, there'll be opportunities for more leisure. You know, I'm an optimist about the future. Actually, Keynes didn't have any grandchildren, but he was right, of course.
Yeah.
If you were writing a letter to your grandchildren, would you be an optimist like Keynes, or would you paint a rather darker future in, say, 65?
I think Keynes got, and I say this with the benefit of 100 years hindsight, but Keynes got one thing fantastically right in that letter, which was that he predicted the extraordinary increase in material prosperity that would happen in the century that followed.
He was wrong about work, wasn't he?
He was wrong, but he was also wrong, and this is quite profound, in the sense that he ignored the distribution problem. He failed to recognize that this material prosperity would not be shared out equally among everyone.
Well, actually, in fairness to him, in 1970 it was actually. I mean, inequality in 1970 was lower than in 1935. It's just got much, much worse since then. Mm. I mean, that's what's happened.
Mm. When I'm criticizing Keynes here, I'm stepping back and looking at the global picture, which is that, you know, for most of human history, global GDP per capita was about $200 or $300. Today, it's about $11,000, $12,000. You know, we've come very close to solving what Keynes called, you know, the struggle for subsistence, the traditional economic problem. But when I say that he didn't get the distributional stuff right, what I mean is that, you know, for many people, their slice of the pie, and even in the 1970s, when you take the kind of global picture, is far away. And, you know, most people just get a few crumbs. And so it's this distributional question of how, as we become more and more prosperous through these technologies, how do we share out that prosperity? And the big theme of my work is that the only way to do it is through the state, that we need...
I'm afraid, Daniel, this suggests that you may have liberal left leanings. I mean, you may...
I'm not afraid of that at all. I'm not afraid of that at all. But I talk about, in the book, the big state, which doesn't sound particularly liberal at all. But what I think, though, and I qualify it quite heavily, is that this isn't the big state of the 20th century. It's not teams of smart people sitting in central government offices trying to command and control economic affairs. It's not a big state of production. It's a big state of distribution. It's a state that recognizes that if the market mechanism is failing to share out this extraordinary prosperity, then the state has to step forward and do far more instead.
I have a different way of conceptualizing this, but it hooks into yours. I've become a kind of real passionate advocate of experimental governance. And this is the notion that, you know, top-down planning, 20th century style, plainly failed. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you don't need to coordinate activity for the common good is equally absurd. Mm-hmm. What these technologies open up to us is the opportunity of actually decentralized decision-making, mm-hmm. understanding in real time what the consequences of some of these decisions are, if they're moving in the wrong direction, having the opportunity to correct them. I mean, you can really do smarter kind of governance. And if you're going to govern this world that's emerging, you're going to have some kind of form of governance like that, aren't you?
Mm. I think that's exactly right. That the sort of institutions of collective deliberation of society should in no sense be immune from these technological disruptions either.
Let's now pull this together. We're getting near the end of the conversation. I mean, we've discussed the challenge, the fork in the road, the potential responses, the opportunities. Why don't I give you 1 minute without repetition or deviation to set out the Susskind stool?
I mean, every day we hear stories of systems and machines that are taking on tasks and activities that until recently we thought only human beings alone could ever do. And I've mentioned lots of these already: making medical diagnoses and driving cars, drafting legal contracts and designing buildings, composing music, writing news reports. There's a whole spread of them.
And they're white collar.
Many of them are taking on activities done by our most expert human beings. That's exactly right.
The middle classes.
The middle classes.
And the upper middle classes.
And the upper middle classes. And You know, what does all of this mean for the vast majority of us for whom our jobs are our main, if not our only, source of income? You know, I think this is one of the greatest questions of our time. And I don't think we're taking seriously enough the threat of a world where there's not enough good work for people to do because of the technological progress that's taking place. Now, just to be clear, I don't think, and I hope this has been clear in our conversation, I don't think there's going to be some big technological bang where everyone wakes up and finds themselves without work. I don't think that's going to happen. As you said at the start, my view is that work is going to remain for some time to come. What I worry about is a far more gradual problem, that as we move through the 21st century, more and more people are going to find themselves unable to make the kind of economic contributions to society that they might have hoped or expected to make in the 20th century, given the kind of education that they had, given the kind of background that they came from. So I think it's a less cinematic, it's a less dramatic threat, but I don't think it's any less consequential. And I think it's something that we can already catch a glimpse of in labour markets today. This isn't a looming threat waiting for us in the distance, and it's only going to get more significant. But we do have control. We can try and change the direction that technological progress takes, and I think that is one of the great, you know, political policy challenges of the time.
And there's implications for government. We've discussed that. There's been implications for actually the middle class. Mm. The beneficiaries of this technology may be working class women, for whom the multiple jobs open up, whereas kind of middle class men are going to find their jobs taken away. I mean, that's kind of what I mean.
I think some of these issues around identity and identity mismatches in society are really important and underexplored. Not just a Western story either. You know, you look to somewhere like South Korea. If you look at the unemployed population in South Korea, a very large number of them, really striking number of them, are very well educated. Why are they unemployed? Not because there's not enough work to be done there, but it's the kind of work that they just didn't think they went to university to do. And they're willing to stay unemployed rather than take it up. And these mismatches of who we think we are and what work is available to us are going to just become more and more profound.
And lastly, I'm a great advocate of, a lifelong advocate of it, a social contract. Mm. How would you reconfigure social security, support for housing, support for incomes, support for training, support for education, support for health? I mean, there's two implications, I think. One, to the extent that we've allowed our social contract to shrivel over the last 40 years, that process must be reversed. Two, it's not a question of reversing it, it's a question of redesigning it.
Mm. I'd want to, in what you just said, really emphasize that first point. And this is one of the big themes of my work, that we need to have a far more expansive view of the state's role in sharing out prosperity in society. That our traditional approach until now has been sharing out prosperity through the work that people do and the incomes that they earn. And if the labour market is less effective at doing that, then we need the state to do it. And it's not simply the state adopting a universal basic income and giving everyone cash. It's just a state that is far more ambitious and bold and generous in sharing out prosperity, whether it's through a better education system, whether it's through better housing, whatever it might be. But accepting and recognizing that the solution to many of these problems is a larger state that takes on a larger redistributional role in our lives in the 21st century, I think is really important.
Daniel, it's been a fascinating 40 minutes. Thank you so much. You really have taken us on a kind of, you've held our hands really, taking us on a tour about, you know, what robots, artificial intelligence, ChatGPT and all of it can do. You've been both upbeat about the possibilities and also warned us about who's going to lose their work. You've said it's a process, not a big bang. You've told us that however you cut it, there has to be an enlarged role for public agency to ensure that these processes work for the common good, a larger role for the state in actually, and the state itself has got to rethink how it does stuff. Everyone's got to rethink how they do stuff. And you've told us that we're going to end up with a larger state that's going to urgently ensure that actually work and wealth and prosperity and above all, that the shaping of the technologies work for the common good. It's been a fascinating, fascinating podcast. Thank you very much for coming. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Real pleasure.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.